If you will, please join me in welcoming to Tulsa from Studio City, California, Don G.
You gotta sell that house, is my friend.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Don Gates, an alcoholic. Yeah, I began to be a fan of your local AA as soon as I met this fellow Wayne at the airport, because he had asked me, as he indicated, a number of things. And he, among others, he said, you know, how will I know you? And I said, well, it's very easy to recognize me, apart from that spiritual halo that, because I've gotten tired of getting off airplanes and not being able to meet people. You know, we can't recognize each other, and we alcoholics are extraordinarily sensitive. We hate to ask, and you find yourself hanging around the men's room in an airport, and it's, So I told him I have worked out a solution for it. I wait until everyone else has left the airplane, and then I come walking out, and the person who is there to meet me, it's easy for me to identify him because he's frantic. He's at, he didn't come. And that's true, by the way. So I got off the airplane today and wandered out, and here in the middle of your airport, with dozens of people looking, is Wayne, and he's wearing a hat on which he's got a big sign printed, "I'm frantic." I like that in a man. No self-respect at all. Now, there's a sort of sick humor that I think really is what makes AA function. And you folks here in this area have it, I think, more so than at least outside of Los Angeles. Of any place that I know, I remember I was speaking at another Texas group or something one time, and a guy called me to verify that the plans had been made and completed, and I assured him they had. And then he said, do you have any insurance for your flight? Have you taken out any insurance for the airplane flight? I said, no, I haven't. Why? He said, why don't you take out a couple hundred thousand? Put it in my name, I'll pay for it. And I said, well, why should I do that? And he said, I don't know, I just feel lucky today. It is an astonishing group standing up here. You're really very beautiful people. I'm impressed. There's a lot of young people here, too, and a number of them came up and spoke to me, and we're having a certain amount of adjustment problems in Los Angeles because of all of the young people coming in, and some of the old-timers find it hard to accept the inevitable fact that all of them come in with hyphenated problems nowadays. In other words, they go through the bit of identifying by saying, I'm an alcoholic addict, or something like that, and which is a gross redundancy. I mean, that's like saying, I live in Tulsa, in Oklahoma. But I understand why they do it for a period of time, because there's, I suppose it's inevitable that no one under age 30 today, probably under age 40, comes into AA a pure alcoholic. There's too much better living through chemistry available now to augment the problem, and I have never known an alcoholic who turned down anything on moral principles or... So everyone under age 40, I'm sure, is a common... I'm 41, by the way. I don't speak about the other chemicals because I don't know anything about them. My ability to resist things that have never been tendered to me is astonishing. And I am sure that if they had been around when I was here, I would have taken them. In fact, I can't imagine an alcoholic not doing so. I mean, can you really visualize you of my generation, if someone had come up to you and said, take a puff of this or try one of these, it'll get you there quicker or better, and you'd have said, no, thank you, I'm killing myself this way. I'm sure we would have tried it. The only thing was that I heard a guy about my age the other day to say that when he was drinking, all he knew about such matters was that Spanish Fly was an upper and saltpeter was a downer. But it is getting sometimes a little mysterious there. I went to a meeting in Hollywood, a very strange meeting. A lot of very strange meetings in Hollywood, but this particular one, they got up, I think it's called an Anything Goes meeting or something like that, but they got up and not only gave the usual hyphenations, they added an explicit identification of their chemist goals of favor. You damn near had to be a pharmacologist to follow some of it. I had never even heard of it. But most of it I could understand. But when you do that, there arises seemingly a certain competitiveness. If we can't be the best, we're going to be the worst, and we're going to be the top of something. And they began to compete with each other. And finally, a young woman got up, obviously of some affluence and stature, because she was dressed in a real rag. You wouldn't go out on the street looking like that unless you were very wealthy. And she got up and rather haughtily announced, I'm only into freebase cocaine. And I thought, oh, the poor dear. You'll never know the joy of a week's run on Muscatel. I mean, think of the specialization. You're trapped in it like a koala bear. You run out of eucalyptus, you're screwed. So by and large, I restrict my remarks to alcoholism, and that's not really true. You can't restrict your remarks to alcoholism, because if you did, you would finish your talk in about 30 seconds if you were burdened with any honesty, because alcoholism, at least after a number of years of sobriety, becomes to many of us the simplest disorder ever to have afflicted mankind, the most easily identifiable, recognizable, and treatable. You know, the very name, alcoholism, gives you such a marked clue as to what the problem is. No, if one were not handicapped with a degree in psychology, and someone came up to them and said, "What do you think causes alcoholism?" I warrant they would make the correct guess immediately. Alcohol? Right. If alcohol had never been invented, there wouldn't be one alcoholic on the face of the earth. Because except for the phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink, our book tells us that we don't have anything in common one with each other, that we don't share with the rest of mankind. You know, there have been no new emotions invented in the last 10 millennia, so far as I'm aware. We have a phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. Non-alcoholics don't. And it's a physical condition. It has nothing to do with your race, creed, color, sexual preference, educational background, social standing, occupation. One person in 10 who drinks is going to be an alcoholic. Now, we haven't had 10 men walk on the face of the moon yet. One of them's already in AA. They check those people fairly close. They're not wired right. They don't send them out. That doesn't mean that we don't have psychotics on our program. Of course we do. Why should they get off any easier than the rest of us? One person in 10 who has anything about his personality that is unique is going to be an alcoholic, and the other 9 people with that same trait won't be. You know, the speakers, of course, I guess it's because we have to fill in time. So if the speakers get up and under the guise of describing alcoholism, they talk about their own hang-ups, which may or may not have anything to do with you. They are problems they're going to have to face. I remember when I first came on the program, there was a guy who used to point his finger out at the audience and say, "If you want to stay sober, the first thing you're going to have to do is admit you're a thief." Because all alcoholics are thieves. You know, well, that really shook me, because at least in the financial sense, I was not a thief. Maybe I didn't need it desperately enough, or maybe I was too frightened. I don't know what it was, but I did not steal money. I stole many other things, affection and kindness and people's time and so on. But money I didn't steal. And it disturbed me to hear this guy say that. But I thought about it for a bit, and I thought that is not a very validly based statement. He doesn't know all alcoholics. At a maximum, no matter how social he is, he couldn't know more than a few hundred. And any person who gets up and says something about all of any class tells more about himself than he tells about that class. If he says all alcoholics are thieves and I'm an alcoholic, I had enough logic to realize he's told me something. He's a thief. And we've been sober together quite a while, and I've never lent him any money. And he's ripped some newcomers you wouldn't believe. I mean, God, it's beautiful. You come on the program and God provides. I thought it meant you were supposed to go to work. It doesn't. You can stay sober just beating newcomers. But I had another guy. He was even more disconcerting. He would point out his finger and say, "If you want to stay sober, the first thing you're going to have to do is get honest with yourself and admit you're a latent homosexual. Because all alcoholics are latent homosexuals." Well, this was even more disconcerting than that thief proposition. I'm on pretty shaky ground about then trying to get sober, and this guy's telling me I'm going to have to give up boys. You know, I mean, hell, I hadn't even tried them, and as far as I knew, they might be the answer. My wife certainly was, by God, she was getting out of hand. But then I made the same deduction about him. I thought, now just a minute. he's telling something about all of a given group, and then he's placing himself in that group. He doesn't know anything about all of that group, but I know something about him. We've gotten along together now for years. We're not close, you know, but I don't know him in the biblical sense, but So you have to be slightly careful when people get up and they talk about alcoholism and then they describe some weird little hang-up that's bothering them. It may or may not bother you. Most of them will, as a practical matter, because they will be describing characteristics that have troubled mankind, that trouble everyone. You know, we often act as if the non-alcoholic didn't have problems. I hear people get up and say, I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a living problem. Well, I understand what they mean, but is the implication of that supposed to mean that non-alcoholics have dead problems?
See?
What the hell do you think they have? People say, I sometimes come awake at night and I just don't feel I'm able to compete. I feel insecure. I guess that's alcoholism. No, it isn't. That's a reality situation. That's an ability to judge your own qualities. All people have feelings of doubt about themselves. I'm sure the Caesars and the Pharaohs awoke in the middle of the night, you know, and thought, who am I fooling with this stupid laurel wreath? You know, I'm no Caesar, just an Italian boy trying to get by, and they come around. You know, and we describe things that are natural to every two-legged beast who ever walked out of the forest, and then we classify them as alcoholism. I heard a guy the other day, he said, oh, long before I started drinking, I was an alcoholic. I had the ism. Now, that's a quaintness that has sprung up lately that'll make you vomit up your sleeve if you analyze it. But, you know, he said, I had the ism even as a boy. By the time I was 10 years old, I already felt immature. It's a frightening thing, really, to realize that the non-alcoholic is exactly like we were before we quit drinking. You know. Weird, strange, fouled up. See, we use the word normal in reference to non-alcoholics, meaning usually something other than in the statistic majority, which would be an apt use of the expression if you limit it to that, but we use it as if we meant the non-alcoholics are people who have their lives together, that they have looked upon the universe and carefully gathered empirical data upon which to bring together rational thought, and they have acted upon it and now lead rich, full, and fruitful lives. Anybody who believes that is true of the non-alcoholic world has not read a book, a newspaper, looked at a television set, or even out the window of their home in a long, long time. The non-alcoholic world is stark, raving, mad, crazy. They're rushing around, looking out for number one, getting even, paying back, protecting, protesting, fighting. You know, I watch them downtown where I work. You know, I'm going to get that bitch on the stand, make her admit she's an unfit mother right in front of the children. They don't want justice, they want blood. And they never have to change. They stay that way the balance of their lives. They don't have to change. Why should they change? They're no different than we are. No one ever gives up a lifetime of failure without a struggle. And why would they quit? Nothing happens to them. They get locked jaws, ulcers. Nothing. No one has ever been arrested for driving while pissed off. You know, you don't get booked for being a common mope, whining and disorderly or anything like that. It's because when we get into those conditions, those dubious luxuries of resentment and self-pity, we get drunk. And when we get drunk, we come into conflict in a way that will be so horrible, ultimately, that we are willing to do those things which will force us, against our better judgment, to live a happy, contented, and fruitful life. There's nothing novel in AA. I've yet to read anything in AA literature, folklore, or from the speakers that was any different than I had been told all of my life. Every sage, every elder of the village, every prophet, every spiritual leader, every thoughtful psychologist, psychiatrist, who's ever reflected on the subject of how to live a good and happy and fruitful and contented life has recommended the same things. Nothing unique about our program. It's simply that we have to do it. They don't. We don't do it because we want to. I doubt many of us would cross the street if we thought it would make us feel better. I wouldn't give you the satisfaction. I'll stay right here and hurt. I can hold out longer than you can. But we are fortunate. We're alcoholics, and booze and time instills that state of sweet reasonableness known only to the dying that is a prerequisite to actively involving yourself in the program. It's really frightening to think the world is in the hands of the non-alcoholic. Because, you know, we didn't endanger society, even at the height of our drinking. We weren't social menaces. Oh, I mean, we bloodied the highways, jammed the divorce courts, the prisons, and the mental institutions, and broke the heart of everybody we came in contact with, but we didn't endanger Western civilization. We weren't that well organized. You know, it's the non-alcoholic who does that. Look at the things they do out there. And one of my favorites was the Falkland Islands, two great nations fighting over a frozen stone, and as far as we know, both sides sober. I'm always fascinated by Beirut and Lebanon, you know, three great religious movements getting together to solve a problem. Deal, deal! A is a little series of islands in a lunatic sea. You don't have to be at all crazy to come to AA or make this program. On the other hand, by the way, it's no handicap if you are. In fact, if you're truly disturbed mentally but are able to stay sober, the chances are very good that you're going to become a leader, a guru, start many groups, have many babies. Yeah. You will not be able to find your ass with both hands, but you can lead the multitudes out of the wilderness. See, because alcoholism is so simple. The way you recognize, well, the thing is, the fact that it's simple is beside the point. I'm sure that people are sitting here probably tonight wondering if they're alcoholic. Am I really alcoholic? You know, as if their opinion meant a shit. I don't mean to get into those scatological phrases. I apologize for that. It's an expression we use in the judiciary, but it describes oral argument by lawyers. In other words, it's a physical condition. The phenomenon of craving results from taking the first drink. What difference would it make what a diabetic thought about his condition? Would his opinion have any possible materiality? What relevance is there in the view of a man with hemorrhoids regarding his condition, assuming he can get into a position to have a view? What difference does what he thinks about it mean? The only possible significance in your opinion of your condition is determines how you're going to die, whether after a pleasant life or in the gutter chewing your tongue hated by everybody you ever met. And that's a thing that probably doesn't mean a hell of a lot except to the individual. you know, if there is any, if there are any doubters here, by the way, and they don't, like they're saying, am I really alcoholic? They could be even at this meeting. All you have to do to find out is ask yourself one question and be candid about the answer. Just ask yourself this. Am I now, or have I ever been, in attendance at an AA meeting? If the answer is yes, you're an alcoholic. It's that simple. Non-alcoholics do not come to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. In the history of our organization, we've never had a non-alcoholic come into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting wondering if he's an alcoholic. What the hell would they come here for? It'll be like a virgin going in for a rabbit test or something. It was utterly absurd. If you're here, you're an alcoholic, of course. What the hell? And the solution to the problem of alcoholism, the part that can be solved immediately, is you don't drink. Now, there's nothing mysterious about not drinking. All it takes is the ability to control the movement of your elbow. Maybe some are too far gone that spastic, like their arm reaches out and hurls things. But assume you can fend it off in time, eternal sobriety is yours. Nothing more than that. The only thing is, you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it until you work on the only part of the disease that can be worked on. And in a way, that isn't even part of the disease. It's the part that makes it necessary for us to come to AA. And that is the fact that along with this physical allergy, which we're going to die with, drunk or sober, is an obsession. That means we're keep going back over and over again. Now, that obsession has nothing to do with insanity or neuroses. People will get up and they'll describe their condition saying, I get into a market and I get terrified and run. That's alcoholism. No, it isn't. That's agoraphobia. Plenty of non-alcoholics have that. But it's something they have to work on, obviously. But tell us what that is, too. What is it? It's read like in chapter 3 at most meetings. The great obsession of the abnormal drinker is what? The persistence of the illusion that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking. And that's what sends us out there over and over again, despite the accumulation of empirical evidence that's overwhelming. That's what's going to happen. And that's what we work on. We work the steps of this program because it allows us to have a mental, emotional condition where we don't get set, our emotional barometer doesn't get set for a spell of storm, and we don't have to take that first drink. We don't have to convince ourselves that this time it's going to be different. You know, one of the tough things about this talk, I wish I had half a dozen people or more when I was here earlier came up and said, I heard your tape. It's on. I haven't heard that tape. And I haven't the faintest, I'm probably saying either the same things I said before, which maybe is all right since they did ask me again. I really don't know. But it's tough to compete against your own damn tape when you don't know what's on it. And a number of them said, tell at least one drunk story. Tell a story about, and then they tell you this weird story. Now, I have given pitches, simple little messages from the heart that you could build a life on. I have called people after the meeting for individual healing. Do they remember any of those things? No. They remember some utterly degrading story that you tell. And I told this one because I don't usually describe my drinking. To tell you what happened to me when I drank would not tell you what I was like, because I was not like that. It just happened to me. See, I didn't plan it. A friend of mine, you know, talks about how there was a misunderstanding between him and the rest of society because he always judged himself by his intentions. whereas they judged him by his actions. And I will measure my intentions against anybody. I never planned those things. To tell you what happened, I used to think I did things before I got to AA, and then in retrospect, I see I didn't do anything. It just happened to me. I didn't plan to be an alcoholic. I never walked into some doctor's office and said, I think I'd like to major in vomiting. Perhaps with a minor in diarrhea. I never planned an evening the way it went. I hear people say, I can't blame the things I did whilst drinking on the booze. And I always think, oh, you poor, pathetic soul. And that must be truly tragic. I can. I blame damn near all of it. I don't think I ever planned an evening the way it went. I never said to myself, well, let's see, it's Friday night. What do we do? I got about a pint here in the house. I think I'll kill that, then I'll go out and total the car. I've just canceled the insurance to save money, so that'll be a good start. Maybe on the way to the hospital, with any luck, the ambulance attendant will roll me. I'll have no identification. I have to spend 28 hours down in general before I can get out. But I'll be able to cuff another jug on the way home, and then I can terrorize the wife and children all day Sunday. That'll be a pretty good weekend. Let's get it on. You know, I mean, it's manifest I'm far too urbane and sophisticated to do a thing like that, but it happened to me. But that doesn't tell you what I was like. Because I was like every other newcomer that I ever met in AA. A good, kind, loving, gentle, compassionate, giving soul. Like one of our ex-presidents from a nearby state who used to say, come, let us reason together. Let us do it my way. You know, and they won't do it. But I used to tell this one story, and several people there have asked me to do it, because it was the first identification I think I had that maybe drink in and of itself was a problem. And most of the time we don't recognize the source of the problem, because to have difficulties with society means you have to come in conflict with some third person. And they contribute to the situation. In other words, if he hadn't have made a left turn, I wouldn't have hit him. Which is true, but if I hadn't have been an unguided missile coming down the street, I'd have seen he was making the left turn. So you can usually rationalize each individual episode, because they involve other people. And the first time I can remember that I had an example that caught my eye or attention was this, and this I will tell, and I won't get into the drinking any further, but I used to drink largely to relax. And on this particular occasion that I'm going to describe, I've been relaxed about 4 or 5 days. And I awakened out of a fearful nightmare, a horrible dream in which I was caught up in Dante's Inferno. It was hellfire and imps of the perverse, brimstone, and I was absolutely drenched with perspiration. I clambered to my feet, you know, and staggered about there, trying to get some semblance of order out of all this, wondering what was wrong with me. Was it, you know, it even dawned on me it might even have something to do with my drinking. Until, being perspicacious, I saw a little spire of smoke coming up out of the couch. And I realized that what had happened was my family had retired at some earlier time in the bedrooms, wherever it was they went at night, and while I had passed out, no, I didn't pass out, I had nodded off on the couch, and apparently I had had a cigarette either in my hand or mouth, and it had fallen on this plastic-type covering that couches have, and burned its way through into the matting, where, lacking oxygen to take fire, it had simply spread ember-like until it now encompassed the entire couch. And I could see that there was nothing wrong with my drinking. I had simply been barbecued. so much relieved, I moved to do something about it. I went into the kitchen, got a pitcher of water, came back and tried to pour it in that tiny hole, creating only a rather spectacular cascade onto the carpet. And I knew something more dramatic was called for, so I returned again to the kitchen, came back with a butcher knife, and I slashed the couch open from one end to the other, spread it, and laid bare the burning embers, and then doused them with the soothing balm of the water. And it did indeed subdue them. The only thing is, it also filled the room with acrid black smoke. Now, that's been 40 years ago almost, and I can still remember vividly standing there, my eyes watering, looking down at that slashed and sodden mass, and realizing that almost to a certainty my wife was going to notice it. She was a very keen-eyed woman. There was little that passed her ken around that house, I'll tell you. And though she was a good woman and would do nothing intentionally to assault or assail the manhood of her husband, rob him of his dignity as head of the house, there would be times when, in moments of passion, she would forget herself and say things that were unkind. Things which she would later come to regret, when she had calmed herself. In other words, she might say something cruel like, "You drunken son of a bitch, you did it again." I wanted to spare her this, but I didn't know quite what to do, and I finally thought, well, I'll take the couch out. I'll take it out of the house. I figured she might vaguely remember there had been something on that side of the room, but out of sight, out of mind. The only thing is, now having been relaxed for 5 days, I should be checking into a sanitarium instead of moving furniture. But with that Herculean strength that comes only to the panic-stricken alcoholic, I somehow hefted that monstrosity onto my shoulder, lurched out the front door. We lived on a second-floor apartment at that time. We had a very small balcony with columns. I remember I almost beat myself to death, caroming off the post. Bung, bung, bung. But I made the turn ultimately and got down into the patio, and foresight is not your long suit in those moments, and I hadn't recognized how few places there are to conceal a couch in an apartment patio. So I'm standing there. I should be in a hospital. Instead, I'm holding a couch, legs trembling, and I remember a creek about 5 miles away. And I lurch to my car, and I throw the couch up on top of the car. And then I get in and begin driving to this place of repose I had selected. Now, all I ever really wanted in life was dignity. Didn't mind disaster one whole hell of a lot if I could face it with dignity. But as I drove along the street, I noticed by now, you know, it's daylight. It's 6:30 or 7 and something in the morning. There are people at the corners, the bus stops, with lunch pails and briefcases, and I have no idea how they can stay up that late, but they're out there. And as I drove by, I noticed that they all turned their heads and followed my progress. Eyes wide, mouths agape. My God, it doesn't take much to draw a crowd in California, I'll say that. Until I chanced to pass before an auto dealership that had a very dusty window that acted like a mirror, and I got a reflection of what they were looking at. Here was a gentleman, Natalie, attired in a bathrobe, with a 5 or 6 day growth of beard, driving along the street in a car on which there sits a couch, which previously had not had sufficient oxygen to take fire, but now moving down the road, the wind was going through it like a billows, and the flames were 30, 40 feet. when I got home, I had a difficult time finding someone to blame. My sleeping wife and children hardly seemed responsible for placing their life in peril like that. And so it dawned on me that maybe booze was suspect. Later, by the way, I was to move beyond social drinking. This was early on, I'll tell you. I've already wandered too far, I can see, along the booze thing. I didn't mean to do that because I wanted to... I won't spend any time on that tonight anyhow, but the solution to alcoholism is as simple as the disease. In most meetings, it wasn't done here tonight, but in many meetings, you'll hear read, like the Chinese water torture, a portion of our book which contains an equally subtle caption, How It Works. And they mean that. That's how it works. If you're intellectual, you'll miss that for quite a while. If they called it the psychodynamics of permanent aridity, you might note it, but anything as simple as how it works is going to be obscure. They even put them in order, 1 through 12, for the intellectual's sake. You can figure it out that way. But they literally mean that. You are to do those things, and certain results follow. And there's nothing mysterious about those steps. They're clearly written, they're simplistic, both in their nomenclature and in their function. I don't think a person could really become confused concerning a step study meeting, steps, unless he went to a step study meeting and analyzed them. Because they're that damn simple. Bill wrote them when he was sober less than 4 years. Most of us wouldn't pay any attention to what a four-year-old thinks about anything. And that's what he had. And everybody else had 1 year. And they said, these are the steps we took. If they weren't lying to us, then they well may have been. A lot of mendacity around Cleveland in those days. But if they weren't lying, when did they take them? They took them all in the first year. They didn't know anything about 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years of sobriety. And they work. They always do. The reason people don't try the steps is not because, at least in my view, not because they're fearful they may not work. They don't take them because they're afraid they will. And yet, strangely enough, what's the worst thing that could happen to a person if they were to try the AA program? The very worst that could happen to you is that you'd spend the rest of your life in full possession of your faculties, which at least to date isn't considered cruel and inhuman punishment, though with some faculties maybe it is, I don't know. But we only get one trip on this little blue-white globe we call the Earth, so far as we know. 70 years, roughly, is allotted. Some get a bit more, some a bit less, but on the average 70, you multiply that by 365, and you only get about 25,000 days. I doubt if you were given $25,000 and told to make them last, that you would wad them up by the handful, throw them down the toilet, and flush them away. You can get money back, but you can never get a day back. Every day is irreplaceable, and I despise most about my drinking the days, the weeks, the months that I lost, sodden, drunk like an animal, or hospitalized, getting over the ravages of it, or locked up because I'd done something violent and society was rubbing my nose in it, or planning resentfully for the next one. You know, I don't want to do that anymore. Well, you know, when you say it's the worst thing that could happen to you, you'll know what happens on your trip here on Earth, but that's... I'm right down some nearby street in about half an hour after the meeting. And I suggest that all of us go over there because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. When I got up to speak, I pointed out to them that everything we do is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There will never be another day like this. If you don't do it, whatever it is that's to be done today, you ain't going to do it. This is the only day that's ever going to be like this. And everything you do today is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And as you get older, this becomes very vital. A guy said to me, you know, I don't know whether I talked about this. This may be identical, the one I gave the other day. I don't know why, but I've been on it for a bit. But a guy asked me, why is your program kind of wild and ebullient and you seem enthusiastic and, you know, I've been sober a while and I'm not that. I said, well, I don't know that it's my program. Maybe it's the things I do. What have you done since you've been sober?
Have you learned to fly an airplane? He said, no. I said, I did. Went out to an old anachronistic flight school airport outside of L.A. and took 3 hours of training and soloed. You know, 3 hours, soloed the damn thing. Rented it that weekend, flew clear to San Francisco. It had no instruments, no radio. I didn't know anything about navigation. I just flew over Highway 101. You know, I don't know, baby. Let go, let God, like I do, baby. Over and under the Golden Gate Bridge, why they didn't shoot me down, I don't know. You know, I didn't know you weren't supposed to do that. See, the higher power allows you to do everything. He's the greatest scapegoat in the world. I haven't made a single mistake in decades. Not the slightest error. Not the slightest fault at all. I have not deviated from the path of rectitude in all of those years. On the other hand, God has done some of the stupid, most petty, rotten, stinking, selfish things through me that you could conceive of. See, but if it gives him pleasure to make me look like a horse's ass, which one of you are here to criticize? And a lot of speakers get up here and say that what they tell you is their own opinion. That's not true in my case. What I tell you is the Word of God, and you better listen up, because I've taken a third step. The only thing is he keeps changing his mind all the time and making me look like a fool in mid-sentence. I took my first free-fall parachute jump just before I became a grandfather about 10 years ago. I asked this guy, I said, have you ever tried scuba diving? He said, no. I said, I did. I know you're supposed to study. You put on snorkels. You fool around. I'm not... Hum a couple of bars, I'll pick it up. I mean, that's my attitude toward life. And I put on everything and dove off out of Catalina Island the first time I ever had it on. I swam around down Seaweed City, 30, 40 feet down. Beautiful down there. Ran out of air. I put my higher power to the test, I'll tell you. I got through the male menopause racing motorcycles with Steve McQueen out in the desert there. The only copy of the big book they used to see out around Mojave. I couldn't have done any of those things drinking. I had to be dignified. Besides, I was immobile a great deal. You know, and all sorts of wonderful things. I'm sure I talked about these because... I don't want to make the newcomer think it's all happiness out there. I don't want you to be discouraged and run out. It's not all happy. Though you can even bear that after a while. There will be moments of misery so exquisite they'll curl your hair in here. Things will happen to you as happens to every two-legged beast who ever walked out of the forest. People are still going to reject you. They're going to abandon you. There's going to be injustice, illness, death, sickness. You're going to know all of the things that flesh are heir to. Society doesn't walk on its tippy toes. The universe doesn't dance around not to upset my tender psyche just because I quit drinking. These things are going to happen, but you will face them and get through them, grow from them. But they're tough. I remember a few years back, I had my life in order, my wife and children and so on, and my wife was called to do other things, and I was left alone with this teenage son of mine. Now, I hear people, we were talking about that at dinner, you know, how people say, as a result of this wonderful program, I learned to talk with my children one-to-one. Anyone who says he talks to his teenage son one-to-one will lie about other things as well. Hell, you're not supposed to communicate with a pubescent son. He lived in the front room, I lived in the rear. The only time I saw him, I used to throw money in the hall, you know, when he came out. Because they're in adolescence. They're going through the agonies of the damned, and they're utterly inarticulate. They can't speak. I remember my daughters, they're going through it. They come home crying, and I say, what's wrong? And they say, that boy. What boy? What did he do to you? He looked at me. What do you mean he looked at you? How do you look at you? Funny. What do you mean funny? They're dying, and they can't communicate. They have no verbal expression or no background against which to pose their pictures. Oh, occasionally they put their primordial grunts to music and play it in their rooms, but communication is not theirs. And, you know, but he and I lived and we got through it. And after a few years, a young woman came along, dreadfully young. I'd been sober 17 years now. I don't monkey with newcomers, but she came along and ventured in where wiser heads would fear to tread. And we just had our fifth anniversary the other day, and she seems to like me. And that's a wonderful thing. She doesn't even mind old age creeping on her at night. And and my work went to hell a few years back, and I thought it was going to fall apart, and now it has changed and improved. I don't know where I told the story or not, but one of the lowest ebbs I ever experienced was about 25 years ago. I had gone into a law firm looking for work, and I had been around AA long enough to know that we can bring merriment with our little recitations of our picadillos while drinking. But no one had told me that they didn't appear funny to the non-alcoholic. And I wanted these people to love me, not for my own sake. I'd outgrown the need for human affection. I wanted them to love me to the glory of your name and to get a job, so I told them a few little icebreakers about how I got drunk and threw my mother-in-law down the steps and being intoxicated, fell after her and got a double hernia, something like that. And this guy didn't giggle a gig or titter a tit. He just kind of stared. And I thought, well, I guess I'm too subtle. So I told them about the time I was in 4-point restraint and vomited straight up. And I did get a reaction. But finally, I could see I wasn't really getting home to him, and I said, now look, I'm not asking you to recommend you. No attorney in the history of this nation has ever done the things that you've done, or had happened to him the things that have happened to you. I wouldn't offer your name for consideration. I recommend you go into the countryside and try to gain your health in simple labor. When attorneys from this firm walk into a courtroom, they represent integrity, strength in the face of adversity, honor. Send you? Boy, I'll tell you, I wasn't ready for that. I wanted to slither like a serpent. If I could have done so, I'd have gone on my belly right out that room and down to the nearest bar to drown the shame of it in that bottomless bottle, just like I always had. But I thought, no, if I do it, by God, he'll be right. I can't take it, and I won't give him the satisfaction. And I went out the old clubhouse we had out there and drank coffee at him. And about 10 years later, that guy flipped out. Just cold sober, flipped out absolutely. Took a secretary and a check protector and ran to Europe. I mean, he disgraced the company, his family, his occupation. One of the most beautiful pyrotechnics I've ever seen. He was cold sober. Just crazy. A few years back, the governor of our state called me and told me he was appointing me to the appellate bench. As far as I know, the highest judicial office ever held by a sober alcoholic. You know what happens now when I'm in a courtroom and one of those members of that firm are there? They stand up. And they don't sit down till I tell them to. All power to the powerless. Now, that's a story that you couldn't get on a television show. You couldn't get that on a soap opera. There is no way to go from the lockups and the pits and the agony and the blackness of where I was to sitting in the highest court in our state. The court that 25 years ago was trying to decide what to do with me. It just can't happen. But in AA, that's the kind of America we expect. Commonplace. I haven't changed all that much. I really have not. I wish I could tell you I have. I haven't. Oh, I don't drink anymore, which is the greatest possible change that can be wrought in the life of an alcoholic. I've learned to laugh at myself. And if you don't learn to laugh at yourself, by the way, you're going to miss the greatest joke in your own generation. I wanted to know that. And I think and do AA. Like one day, I mentioned that oral argument. I shouldn't do that, but that's a tough thing for me. It was sound and fury signifying nothing. And I was sitting there one afternoon early on, and I guess my prostate was acting up, and this one attorney was going on too long, and I leaned over the bench, and I zinged him, and I made everybody in the courtroom laugh at him. You know, and I just despised myself for that. Just loathed myself. I mean, this was his big moment. He was finally going to appear before an appellate court, and he stood in awe before those black-robed figures. His hands were shaking, and his voice was breaking as he began this monumental argument. You know, Paul Muni defending Dreyfus. And I'd leaned forward and zinged him. I just felt hideous and horrible about it. And the next day I came to work, and I searched out where he worked and the firm he was, and I found him. Finally, I got through to him personally, and I said, "Look, I'm extremely, Judge Gates, I'm extremely sorry for what I did to you yesterday. You'd written a brilliant brief. I'm sure you would have given an equally brilliant argument if I'd have allowed you to. But I'm learning. I'm an old man. An old man has to learn. Kids learn to ride bicycles. I'm learning to ride the bench. I was very, very, very bad in there last night, yesterday, and I hope you'll forgive me." Your Honor, oh, thank you, Your Honor, thank you, Your Honor. Because judges don't do that. See, I mean, I not only made his day, I might have made his career. I don't know. But I didn't call him to make him feel better. I did it because I had to do it. Our program says, when you are wrong, you promptly admit it. It doesn't say, unless you're a judge. Okay. But I do those crazy things. Sometimes I can't help it. Somebody mentioned, I told a story where there was a large murder case, and they were arguing in front of us, and this one attorney wanted us not to be too harsh on his client, even though his client hadn't been entirely truthful when he'd been apprehended. And I hear one of these solemn robed figures lean forward, because it's me and I had a good seat, and I heard myself say to this fella, "Do not worry, counselor. We all understand that one of the problems with murder is that it leads to lying. Because I know what honesty means. If he keeps that up, he'll start drinking and be in real trouble." I didn't add that last part, but I am. Now, this program is filled with miracles. It really is. Yours won't be like mine, maybe, but it will be as good or greater. The other day I heard a person describe how they'd been abused as a child, and they became a drunk, and they abused their children, and I hated to hear the goddamn story. I wanted to punch him in the mouth even as he was talking about it. But then he got into AA, and now he and his children have a loving, warm relationship. That's a miracle. I would much rather see a child abuse chain stopped than see a man become a judge. See, every story in here is a miracle. I don't know what yours is, but if any of you leaves before you find out, you will have missed a great deal. Thank you.